Okay, can you hear me at the back? Good, thank you. So, yeah, just to explain the history, back in 2005, we started building custom distributions for real-time audio, low latency. And that was back in, as I say, 2005. Free Akinayaka, my colleague, found a tool called PDK, developed at Progeny Linux Systems, which was in Murdoch's company, one of the founders of Debian. And Free developed an enhancement to that to help resolve all the dependencies that you have in a distribution so that you no longer have to specify each individual package that you need. You just say the ones that you want, and the system takes care of filling in all the blanks for you. So we built a distribution for AMD 64, which we thought was the way to go at the time, and as it proved to be, the Opteron processor, the first AMD 64 processor, turned out to be a really good choice for audio workstations. And so we built this distribution based on Debian. It was quite popular for a few years, and eventually we persuaded the sort of mainstream Debian community that AMD 64 for audio was a really good thing, and Debian itself began shipping a real-time AMD 64 kernel, and other package improvements that we were able to push back into mainstream Debian meant it was no longer necessary to have a separate distribution from Debian itself. So we're very happy about that. So my colleague Chris joined us straight from school in, 10 years ago for work experience, and proved himself to be a very able developer, and we've been working together on our projects ever since. So one of the projects that Chris has been doing has been developing this tool, PDK, so that it works for ARM. So these small embedded devices like the Raspberry Pi and the BeagleBone Black and things like that. So because originally we were only targeting workstations, so we were making ISO images for CDRs and DVD-Rs that people would install their system from, and then they would update it on a hard disk. Of course, with ARM systems, not only do you have a different architecture, but you have a different way of booting and making system images and things like that. So Chris has done a lot of work on those tools. So we create these custom distributions, generally based on Debian, for media projects. So it tends to be real-time audio, but other kinds of media as well. And our two target things are the original AMD 64, which we've always done, and in recent years, these small ARM boards that are so popular now. So with the embedded boards, you've got extra work to do because each board is slightly different. It's not like having a PC architecture where you can kind of rely on the same sort of base components being in place. So you need these board support packages, which are kind of tailored for each individual board with its own unique weirdness. And so we tend to have to target a specific board, such as the Raspberry Pi 3, the BeagleBone Black, to make sure that everything works perfectly, which is actually a good way because it narrows down your options to very specific hardware choices. So as well as that, there's some specialist audio stuff, like the sound cards, for example, because a lot of these ARM devices aren't generally used for real-time audio purposes. You have to often do some work on your audio hardware, your drivers, that kind of thing. And of course, we maintain these absolute minimal distros, which makes it easier for everyone if you only have the packages that you actually need instead of like all the sort of general purpose stuff that you get in a sort of normal distribution. So at the moment, we're working on sort of extending Bluetooth and things like that for some of these devices. The Internet of Things is a very popular buzzword, of course. And we have a couple of sort of fun projects that we do just for the community. Pi Deck is one of them. It's down here. This is DJing on a Raspberry Pi. And we've got a spin-off of that called the Plegger, which is short for the Pi Deck Bootlegger. That's an automated recorder that will enable you to sort of plug in a Raspberry Pi into an audio device and then pick up the recordings on your phone using a web interface sort of in your phone's browser. So a good way of sharing recordings in an open environment like a club or something like that, where you can't physically get behind the mixer and start plugging and unplugging stuff in the middle of a DJ set or something like that. So the ARM boards all come with distributions, usually at least partly supported by their manufacturers, with the kind of the special stuff that I mentioned that each board needs. And, you know, they're general purpose. So they don't know what you're going to use that board for. It could be anything. They put in a lot of different stuff that you don't necessarily need for your project. And, of course, they have their own release cycle. So, you know, they will bring out a new version when they, you know, see fit to do that. And they can be, from our point of view, a little bit bloated, or very much bloated, depending on the distribution. You know, this is a sort of starting point for your own project. However, when you want to roll out packages to users, you don't necessarily want to build off of someone else's base because, as I say, it will be their release cycle, not yours. And just recently, we have supported the BeagleBone Black, thanks to our work with Hertek, the German company that works on a hearing aid development. I don't know if you saw on Friday, there was a presentation about that. And in future, we're looking to support some of the Raspberry Pi clones that are coming out of China, like the Orange Pi and Banana Pi and so on, because they have some interesting features for us, like having more audio channels in the hardware than the Raspberry Pi does. But yeah, the important part is whatever you want to do. So, I mean, I expect you're all familiar with what a GNU Linux distribution looks like. It's a collection of software packages, isn't it? But it's also a community. It's a collection of like-minded developers. And each distribution has different goals, but they're common, and that's what brings that community together around that particular distribution. Some are financial goals, like you've got some very commercially focused distributions. Others are socially focused, like the Debian project, which is sort of run by a non-profit in a very democratic way. So you've got all these different models. And basically, you can break down the distributions into the ones that are based on the Debian system, like Ubuntu, or the ones that are based on Red Hat. And yeah, there are others as well, but they have sort of like they're somewhat outside the mainstream. So if you want to build one of these custom sort of projects on a small ARM board, you know, there are very minimal ways to do that, such as Yocto and Buildroot. And they have their advantages. They make very, very small images. And, you know, there's some nice tools to go with those. And, you know, the industry will support these tools on the various boards, so that's all good. But there are some drawbacks to it. Recompiling everything each time because they don't have a package manager system like these sort of bigger distributions necessarily. And, you know, we'll come on to the benefits of the other approach, but this is a route that we decided not to go down. So yeah, we wanted a middle ground between these very minimal ways of building images and the sort of the bigger distributions that you'd be familiar with from your workstation or server. So the ARM boards are a lot more powerful than traditional embedded boards, so you can treat them a little bit more like a desktop system. We don't need them to be absolutely minimal. They have onboard flash memory, or you can put in a micro SD card, so the sort of amount of storage that you need is doesn't need to be so heavily optimized. And of course, if you're familiar with working with something like Debian on your developer workstation, then you can use the same knowledge that you acquired to work on your ARM project, so that's good. You're already used to these kind of distributions. And of course, with package management, if you're in the middle of, let's say, prototyping a project and you decide you need some extra stuff, whether that's developer tools or just some package you forgot about, you just, you know, apt install it, and there it is. So you don't have to be constantly rebuilding your image every time you make a minor change. And so we have this way of sort of avoiding premature optimization. You know, we can hack around on things and in that familiar environment and decide what it actually is that we really need. And then we can go back and build a very minimal image later using, say, Buildroot, if that's what's actually needed for deployment. But in the meantime, we can work on this sort of system. So you've got all the advantages of working with Debian normally. So you've got your community, all the tutorials out there, the Stack Overflow questions and things like that to solve everyday Debian problems, which makes it a hell of a lot easier than working in a completely unique environment. And because of all these benefits, we can actually trade off some performance for that, at least during the development stage. So why Debian in particular? Well, it's widely used, one of the sort of top three distributions in the world, depending on who you believe. Very, very stable because of the sort of the passion that Debian developers put into that distribution. The QA is remarkable, I think. The levels that they go to make sure that everything works. And you've got all your Debian mailing lists and so on. And just a huge package repository. So if there's anything worth packaging, they have probably done that, unless it's very, very new. And of course, from a commercial point of view, if you're developing a project, there's no one company leading Debian, so you don't have to have a sort of commercial relationship with the sort of the distribution builder to be involved in it. And that's particularly important if you're a small company, because you may not have those commercial relationships with the larger distribution builders. And of course, there's all the benefits of secure apps. So signed packages, you can be sure that if you install Firefox, for example, that it is actually coming from Debian and that it's been sort of QA'd and security checked to the best of their ability. So I think I'll hand over to Chris now and talk about some of the limitations of Debian, which is, we love Debian, but there are some things to be aware of.
How's that? Okay, so Debian only does systemd with glibc. I know there's Duvian that doesn't use systemd, but really we can allow for this in our distros because we're sort of like a desktop distro, aren't we, that we create? So we can allow for that.
So, one of the other things that Chris has highlighted on the slide here is that if you want to pay to get work done in Debian, it's not always straightforward because a lot of developers in Debian are doing it for the love of the project, and it's not like you can just walk up to them and offer them money to sort of take care of some security issue or whatever. That may or may not be a problem, depending on the way that you're used to working. But if you want to pay people to do stuff, you may find that quite awkward in Debian because of the different motivations that people have for working on that project. So it can be considered offensive, I think, to offer people money for certain to perform certain tasks that you need to have done, whereas other distributions are more set up for that kind of thing.
I think the battery's running out the microphone.
Sorry, okay. So while we change the microphone, I'll carry on with the slide. The slow release cycle of Debian. This is something that people often say, it takes longer. They don't have this fixed release cycle like Ubuntu has or whatever. But we've come to discover that a QA-based release cycle is often a lot better than a time-based one. Because if you have a time-based release cycle, you know that certain bugs are going to be remaining in that distribution once the release is shipped. And it's... As you'll see with PDK, the tool that we use, you're creating your own release cycle, in effect, and you will then find that you prefer to have the more QA rather than a quicker upstream release. So Debian can also be somewhat conservative in that if a new breaking change arrives in the sort of free software community, Debian's, sometimes reluctant to adopt that because they prize stability so highly. So, I'll talk a little bit about PDK, the thing that we adopted from Progeny. The original package was sort of middle of the last decade, and the key idea was components. So they called it componentized Linux originally. The idea is that you build a component, which is a collection of packages, and you then maintain that component. You reuse it, sort of like a meta package, but you know, it's sort of for certain tasks. It's slightly different from Debian's way of arranging meta packages, and that instead of just being a list of package names, a component contains very specific package versions. So if you happen to have a situation where the newest version of the package in Debian is not suitable for your needs, has issues that you can't deal with, you can specify like a slightly older version, or one you happen to have used before and you know works. And they're also, these components are also sort of integrated with Git. So you can version control them in the same way that you would any other Git sort of project. So these components can be pulled from our own servers, but you also can make your own. We'll talk about how that's done in a minute. The packages can come from multiple sources. So they can come from Debian itself. They can come from your own repository. They can come from a third-party repository. You can mix and match the exact versions that you want. So originally, we used this for creating sort of the apt repositories, so with all the stuff you want in that, and the ISO images for installing on AMD64 servers and desktops. Now, we also do the ARM boards, as I mentioned. And the thing about running your own apt repo is that if you need your users to update, they can update from you rather than from your parent distribution. So let's say there's a breaking change in Debian that you don't want to roll out to your users. You have them update against your apt repository, not against Debian's. And you put the stuff from Debian into your apt repository when you have QA'd it. So how is it done? We will go to the sort of the full technical demo in just a second. But we recommend installing it on current Debian. Virtual machines are good because you can create and destroy them well, and you can also make them reproducible. So you're not sort of tangling them with any kind of local changes you might have on your machine. At the moment, we're using DigitalOcean virtual servers, and 4 gigabytes of RAM is sufficient, and it's sort of $40 a month for that kind of configuration. So it's a relatively inexpensive infrastructure to run. You can run it on a local machine as well, but you will find that it runs a lot faster when it's on in a data center somewhere with a really good upstream sort of internet connectivity, because we are going to be downloading a lot of packages. So on GitHub, there is the sort of tutorial stuff to follow if you want to do that. Let's give you a second to take a look at that. And let's move on.
Right, so I'm going to run through the instructions and show you all the different files that are installed as part of this process. So first I'm just installing our apt repository onto the system, which I may already have on here. I'm going to add in the apt key as well, because we've got assigned. We should have a signed repository. And I'm going to install the PDK package. Oh. And it's gone wrong. It's archive keyring.
Oh, that's
very silly. Right, so I'm just going to install the two packages here, PDK and PDK MediaGen, and No, I'm not going to do that yet. An update, yeah. So I'm running Debian Stretch on my laptop, Debian SID on my laptop. I should really be running Debian latest.
Yeah, this is why we recommend Debian Stable for your base machine.
It's okay. I can... I can remote into a system that I know works, so it's all good. Right, so back to the instructions. So the first step is to set up an app repository key. And generate the key.
Yeah, I should mention that the error message that you get when you install this package is not actually a problem. What it's doing is it's saying that it's failed to start the service for this particular package, but it's one of those services that needs a bit of configuration before you can run it. For some reason, the Debian package insists on trying to start the service before it's configured. Don't know, but for this tutorial, you don't actually need the service running because we're going to just generate that key like Chris is there.
So I have got an apt key generated on here. So that's good. So next step is to generate or create a workspace with PDK. And if we go into that directory, there is an etc directory and there's a git directory that's already created for us. So we've already got a git repository created. Inside the etc directory, we've got a cache folder which contains all of the Debian packages that we're going to download as part of this process. Obviously, there's not a lot in there at the moment, but that will change very soon. So I've already created all the metadata files that go with this, and that's in a GitHub repository. And if I include those files in there by pulling, we've now got some more files in here. So in here, we've got some Debian packages that we've created ourselves for this project. Do you want to say anything about those packages that we created?
Yep. So these are just for the purposes of the demo. We've got a few sort of unique packages here that you won't find in Debian itself. We've got a package called PyDeck, which is for this particular project. It's sort of post-install configuration, that kind of thing. And one of the reasons we do that is that, let's say you've got a package in Debian that's sort of 99% correct for your needs, but there's one thing you need to change about it. It's often more expedient to use some sort of post-install hook to change that package than it is to maintain your own version of that package in a fork. So that's you know, for these small one-off changes which are specific to a certain project. So we use like a project package which we normally name after the project. In this case, PyDeck. And you'll see there's another custom package, XWax. Now XWax is in Debian. XWax has version 1.7 in Debian, but we want to make some changes to that package as well. So we make our own deb and we put this sort of tilde, PyDeck, that's the project name, to distinguish it from the official Debian version, which wouldn't have that little bit in the file name. And we're going to use that in our custom distribution we're going to make.
So if I look in the etc folder again, there is now a file called channels.xml, And we use XML because that was originally what PDK had in there. So this XML file actually tells PDK where to get its source from. So the path here is all of the Debian testing or Debian Buster packages that we've already generated for PDK. Here we've got the local debs that we've just chatted about that are in the debs folder. We've also got at the bottom the packages that come straight from Debian as well. So if I do a PDK channel update, that actually downloads all of the packages from, downloads the indexes of the packages from Debian. And it also includes the local packages in the debs folder. So if I then do a PDK pull, oops, I'm not as good as the guy last night. That's right. So pull in the components, then pulls in our 64 Studio components into here. And after this is done, I'll show you what it has included. So now we've got this 64 Studio folder here. And inside that folder are the different meta packages that we've created. So
yeah, I should mention that it's not compulsory to use our components. We just provide these to help you get started. You can build your own components and host them yourself if you wish. You can pull them from third parties as well.
So we've got a minimal.xml, which has got every single package that's needed to have a minimal Debian distro. So that includes apt, add user, all these interesting commands that we've found that we need to make the system.
Yeah, it's all the packages you would expect to find in an absolute minimal system. You can make this component as small as you require for your needs, but then you'll often find yourself like, oh, I don't have the add user command. Oh, got to go and install that or whatever. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, the sort of the stuff you could kind of expect to find. And some of these correspond to the package priorities in Debian itself. So they have like an essential priority and you know, other sort of levels. So you can make it as small or as large as you want to. And you'll notice that each one of these packages is versioned. As I mentioned earlier, you don't have to have the latest version from Debian. It might not suit your needs. You might want to hold a package for a while. And it's also got a checksum, an MD5, on that package, so we can tell if it has actually changed or not when we build the distro.
So inside our main project, we've got a file called pydec.xml. And if I edit that file, we'll see at the top there's the ID. And that ID is referring to the Debian version that we're basing off of. These MediaGen commands here, settings, these are referring to the settings we pass to the actual generator that generates the image. We've got the app key here, so that's what we're signing everything with. And at the bottom, we've got a list of components that build up the distro. So you can see that we're including the minimal components, an OpenSSH server, the board support for the Raspberry Pi, JackD2, Xorg, LXDE, and our Pydec packages. So if I download the Pydec packages, instructions don't work. So we've got an abstract command here, which actually adds the packages into the XML file. So
yeah, this is the feature that I mentioned earlier, where instead of instead of having to figure out which packages you need for dependencies, the closure feature will generate that list in, and write out this file, pydec-closure.xml, so that you can resolve all those dependencies automatically.
So for our distro, we need the PyDec package, we need the XWAX package, USB mount, etc. And running the abstract resolve and closure commands generates an XML file that's got all of those packages in it. So let's try that. No. Yeah. Yeah.
The minimal system that you've got, does it use systemd as well?
Do you want to answer that one?
Yeah, so we use systemd at the moment, but it would be possible to pull the packages from a Debian fork that doesn't use systemd. So, but really, we found that using systemd isn't such a bad thing.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, in systemd's favour, I will say that it boots quite quickly on the Raspberry Pi, which is good to have for appliances. On the other hand, a lot of people really don't like it, so you do have the choice.
Aha. Yeah. It does work, I promise. What am I missing?
I'm trying to work it out. The components.
So what was the error on the downloading PyDec?
Can't find packages.
You are running that.
Exactly, yeah.
If you're pulling the components.
Here we go.
Which was the step we missed?
So I didn't do a PDK download of either of the packages. So at the moment, we're downloading all the packages into the cache that's on here. You see everything's referred to as an MD5 hash. This allows us to go between different commits on the Git repository to actually generate an image that, say, 6 months ago worked and today didn't. So if I do a make image now, we should get an image come out ready for the Raspberry Pi.
Okay. So should we edit that that slide?
Yeah.
What is make closure step?
So the make closure step is actually downloading all of the packages and making the references to the packages. So exactly, yeah. So we give it, say, 5 or 6 packages, and then it builds all the dependencies it needs from there.
Yeah, because the sort of the tree of dependencies of dependencies of dependencies can get quite large, even if you're only starting with like a small number of packages that you actually want. And this is why that step had to be automated.
No,
I don't think so. No.
Debian installs recommended packages now by default when you try to install a package. So you do not agree with those.
Yeah, I mean, we are trying to get the smallest image possible.
Yeah. You know? You can include those if you want to.
So, Chris, if we open up another terminal just to take a look at the structure of the project while that's happening. So yeah, it was the LAC project. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was going to say the you've got the pydec.xml. We looked at that earlier, didn't we?
Yeah. So the pydec.xml is like a top level overview of all the components that are included in the distro. So going back to your question about the closure, we don't actually reference all of the packages in here. We reference those in another file, which is pydec-closure.xml. So if we look in there, that may show you a bit more about what we've got in here. So inside this file, the closure command that we ran includes all of the debs that are needed just for that one component. So
yeah, and it also includes DSC references. So one of the issues we came up against when we built the original 64 Studio distribution was that people said, okay, you've built this ISO image, that's great. Where's the matching sources? And we went, okay, well, we better modify PDKs so that it spits out sources at the same time as part of the same build process, so that if people ask for exact matching sources, you can provide them for any one of these custom images. So if we go back to the make file, Chris, that would be useful to see, I think. So this is how we sort of run some of these commands. So like make closure, for example. So this is a shortcut to run these different packages. So we do the abstract command to actually find what all those packages are and write them out to the pydec closure .xml file. Then we have this pdk resolve command to run on that file. And then finally, we run the closure command, which outputs to the file again, pydec-closure.xml for the ARM HF architecture. And I think
But that doesn't include all of the dependencies, because otherwise that PIDEC closure XML would be really large.
Yeah.
So we also include a file PIDEC.xml that has already had the closure command run on it.
Yeah.
So we only include the files in there that we need to. We don't duplicate references to DEBs or anything.
So the PIDEC-closure.xml file contains all the files you hadn't thought of, basically. It's sort of a tidying up step just to make sure you have those dependencies, because otherwise you can build an image, you can install it on your target device, and when someone comes to run the application that you wanted all along, there's some functionality missing, it just doesn't work at all. So that's a good way of keeping track of these dependencies, because sometimes Debian will add new dependencies to a package that aren't in your old recipe for your distribution. So this is the way to handle that. So how are we doing in our other tab?
We're done.
Okay, good.
I think it takes about 5 minutes to create an image. It's not massive.
I think the important thing to note here is that obviously the speed of downloading packages, as I mentioned, is important, but also caching packages. So let's say you have 5 or 6 different projects that you're building off of one base distribution. You don't want to download the add user package, let's say 5 or 6 times. So what we do is we link to a cache, a shared cache for any given distro, and that really speeds up the process of downloading stuff and generating. And saves disk space as well.
But the cache also helps where you have multiple versions of your distro you've created. You can go back in time, and you've already got those DEBs included on your PC.
You have your own copy.
Exactly.
So rather than having to dig around on some sort of Debian archive to find the package version from 6 months ago, you already have it locally.
So also as part of that, there's a folder in here called repo, which is a full Debian repository that's signed. It's got symlinks into the cache, so all of the deb files are there.
So should we have a quick look at the structure of the dists directory? Explain that. Yeah, so in this case, we only have one, which is Buster. But you'll see the structure is exactly the same as a classic apt repository. You've got a release file. Should we have a look at the content of that? And it's also signed with GNU-PG. So you see this is just like as if you were creating an official Debian repository. You've got the code name. You've got the MD5 sums for these individual files, and the so you've got the release files, also the sources files, and the gzipped versions of those. So your target machine, when it's updating against this repo, it can get all of the sort of information it needs to make sure the packages are what they say they are, haven't changed, all that kind of thing.
The speed it creates that repository is quite impressive, really. So if I remove that repo folder and just run the repo gen command, it is created in a matter of seconds because all the packages are symlinks to the cache.
Yeah, so again, we're saving quite a lot of disk space there, aren't we?
Exactly. Which is good as well if you have multiple versions. You can have different repositories for it, and they're just referring back to the cache.
And particularly if you're using like an online virtual cloud server hosting thing, you're paying by the megabyte or gigabyte for disk space. So if you're running 5 or 6 projects, and maybe you're basing them on 3 or 4 different distributions. If you don't use these sort of strategies to conserve disk space, you'll quickly find you're using many, 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 many gigabytes of disk space containing gazillions of Debian packages and all different versions that you've downloaded from different places. So this is something that we did fairly early on to save ourselves quite a bit of hosting money.
So also, we can also version control the parameters we send into the media gen. And the media gem basically creates the image which is run on the Raspberry Pi or whatever. And in here you can choose things like the root password that's used, the host name, what the file name's going to be called, how big you want it to be in megabytes, that sort of thing. So having that version controlled, I think, is quite mega, really, isn't it?
Absolutely, especially for reproducing your results.
Yeah.
I was going to mention the preseed.conf. Should we take a look at that? Because Debian has this feature called preseeding, which is like if you were installing something manually, you'd be at your keyboard and you'd be like entering various options and things like that during the installation process. But we don't want to do that. We want to automate that as much as possible. So the end user doesn't really have any input that they have to make. This is also very good for sort of, you know, like unattended installation. So these are all standard Debian options. So like, what kind of keyboard is the person going to have? You know, we don't necessarily want the user to have to answer that question if they're using an audio appliance that doesn't even have a keyboard. So, you know, for them, it's an irrelevant question. So we can just set it to some reasonable default and let that get taken care of. There's, for audio appliances, there's a particularly interesting option here. I think this is now actually a default in the Jack D2 package in Debian. But at one time, it was not. So you installed Jack D2, and the package manager asked you if you wanted to install the tweak for RT limits for real time. And, you know, if you answered no, your Jack performance would be really bad. So it was kind of not a sensible question to ask in some ways, but it was just part of Debian policy that they didn't want to tweak your system without asking you. As I say, I do think that's the default now, so this is sort of a legacy option. But it's just an example of the kind of thing that you could do to set up a Debian package in a hands-off way.
So the other thing we've got is a post-install script. So after the image is created, the post-install script is run, and we actually install packages in here. We set users up, and we also tell the Raspberry Pi or whatever system it is what options we want to have on boot. So here I'm actually telling LightDM to log in as the user, giving it a X command to not show us with any cursors. So,
and turn the screensaver off, which is a real annoyance if you don't have a keyboard to undo the screensaver and you can't figure out why your appliance display has gone blank. You know? So this file is full of hacks, but they're expedient hacks, because if your Debian package is kind of 99, almost 100% the way you want it, but there's just one little thing you want to change, you can either maintain a fork of that Debian package, or you can just hack it with sed or something like that after installation. And that's, as I say, that's an expedient approach compared to the overhead of maintaining a fork of that package for one tiny, tiny change. Some of these things will be things that you can upstream to Debian itself. If there's some adjustment that makes perfect sense for almost every user, you can work with the Debian maintainer of that package to suggest a configuration change to their defaults. But in a lot of cases, it's very specific to the project that we're doing, and it's not really applicable to the general Debian user, so there's low chance of that sort of tweak being upstreamed. And this is where we put all of those kind of hacks. So it saves a lot of post-install configuration for the user as well. Here's some specific stuff for the Raspberry Pi. We've got this card, the audio injector, and it is this special overlay command put into the boot config. And there's other stuff we want to do. We want to adjust the performance mode for the sort of the CPU frequency scaling. We don't want it to be lowering a power, to sort of save a battery which may not actually exist in our appliance. It might be mains powered. And we want to disable the Bluetooth in this case because we don't use it for our application and it can interfere with the audio on the Raspberry Pi. So are there any questions at this stage? I'll bring the mic back.
So Have you considered a use case where offline upgrades might be necessary? For example, so like with from USB stick, so or just you know you download firmware update to the appliance directly. So yeah, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's more of a brainstorming question, I think. I don't think we've actually implemented that, but it's certainly possible.
So we've got, at the moment, we've just got an apt update, but that assumes the appliance has got internet access, right? So other than that, we can just generate a new image and reflash that to the SD card at the moment. Yeah. Or maybe we could have some sort of local apt repository on a USB stick.
Yeah,
it really, it's all possible, really.
It really depends on your appliance. So if your appliance has user-specific files on it, you're probably going to want to upgrade it in place. But some of the projects we work on are deliberately designed not to have any user files on the device itself. So for example, in the case of the Pi Deck, it's the only user files are on the USB stick with the audio that the user brings. There's nothing specific to any one user on the file. So you're quite able to just reflash when you want to update it. You have the option. So, any other questions? It's all right. You're not restricted to one question each. You can have as many as you want.
Okay, so, I also had a question about whether or not you are using the real-time kernel. And, yeah, so have you ever had the problem of decision between the real-time versus non-real-time kernel, and why did you end up choosing either of them?
That's something of a historical question, because when we started out making the 64 Studio distro, the main application for the Opteron CPU was servers. And they wanted maximum throughput. And there was a lot of skepticism that anybody would use the Opteron as an audio workstation or on a desktop. At all, that was really not what it was aimed at originally. So we showed that the real-time kernel and the AMD 64 was a good combination. And after that, people became more accepting of the idea. So when we first started out and sort of researching this in around 2004, the real-time audio developers did not actually have Opteron CPUs available to them. They were all working on 32-bit Intel platforms. So more recently with these appliances, I think the real-time performance of your standard kernel config is a lot better than it was in 2004, 2005, when throughput was everything, because of this increasing recognition of the value of the real-time kernel for sort of desktop and appliance users. However, for projects where we're trying to squeeze every last drop of performance out, we still do use a real-time kernel. And Chris could maybe talk about the TI kernel patches that we used on the BeagleBone.
Yeah, so we've been using the BeagleBone with a project with Hortec, and not using the real-time kernel led to a lot of performance problems. So having the real-time was necessary in that case. And it really improved things, didn't it?
So yeah, I mean, as I said, when we started out, it was not feasible to run JackD, for example, on a standard desktop-type kernel at all. Now it is more of an option, but for these kind of appliances, we're doing a lot of customization anyway. In the case of the BeagleBone, Texas Instruments, who supply the CPUs and so on for these boards and the chipsets, they do a lot of work to optimize the Linux kernel for their specific board, and you'll often get a better performance using their configuration than you will your standard distro configuration, which has to support a wide number of different boards. So I think we noticed quite a significant performance increase just moving to their sort of maintained tree of patches, didn't we?
Mm.
So yeah, but you have the option. So any more questions?
Yeah.
Okay, but the mic comes back. That's all right.
When you showed the Clojure XML file, I've noticed that you've got the paranoia package in that. And I can't imagine why would you ever need the paranoia on a Raspberry Pi.
Right.
I mean, you very rarely even hook a CD-ROM driver to a Raspberry Pi, right? So
Well, really, that was just a recommendation from the upstream developer to include that on there.
Ah, okay.
We've just not really got around to improving the system yet, so...
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's a case for rebuilding a Debian package with fewer dependencies, just to avoid situations like that. So, for example, Jackd, if you're getting a standard package from Debian, it will often be compiled with dbus support. And, you know, we generally don't want that in a device that doesn't have a GUI. In this particular project, we do have a GUI. We're running X11, and we're running a sort of minimal window manager. We only show one application, which is XWAX. But in another project where, the on the BeagleBone for the hearing aid, there is no GUI. So in that case, we did rebuild Jackd without the dbus dependency. So in the closure file for that project, you would not see dbus. So, yeah. And I think the image is downloaded.
Yep.
So, yeah, actually the longest part of the process is often downloading the image that you created from the cloud machine. But if you're downloading many thousands of packages to the PDK machine, it still works out quicker than running the PDK on your local machine. So we've got this 1.4 gigabyte image. That's certainly not the smallest. It's not the most heavily optimized distribution, as I mentioned, but for the Raspberry Pi, it's actually quite difficult to buy small micro SD cards now, because you go to your supermarket and the smallest one they have available is like 16 gigabytes or something like that. So whereas in theory we could get that down to 1 gigabyte, maybe half a gigabyte, there's not much practical benefit to that, given that the smallest micro SD card you can buy is many times larger. So again, it's a trading off optimization for convenience to some extent. There's a couple of different ways you can deploy these images for your end users. You can use good old DD just to sort of copy that onto the micro SD card. And in recent versions of DD, there's a progress bar option, so you no longer have the mystery, you know, what is going on with my micro SD card while DD does its thing. So that's nice. Another good project I think we should mention is BMAP tools. Can we get that up on the browser, please, Chris? So this is, this is very handy project. Basically, what it does is it enables you to get a sort of a better user experience for installing sort of these images onto micro SD cards. And so I'd just like to recommend that. We used it for our Pi Deck 0.1 release. And I think the main thing is that you create some metadata about the image that you've created, and then you use the BMAP tools to install it to the micro SD card. And you get the progress bar and all that kind of stuff, which DD now has, but it also has some other benefits. One of the things we're looking at that we haven't implemented yet is removing all of the padding from some of these images, so that in theory you can get a quicker download and install experience for some of these, like these larger images, which have to get expanded out to bigger images when they get written to the SD card. So yeah, I'd just like to mention that. And thank Hertek again for their support for developing PDK so that it supports all these little embedded systems. And once we've updated the installation instructions for the tutorial, I hope that you'll give it a try and give us feedback on sort of how we get on with it. So thanks very much.
Thanks for being so patient.